We're going to continue the discussion that we started last week about the fermion masses in the standard model. Of course, we can't write down bare masses for the fermions due to gauge invariance, but we want to generate them through spontaneous symmetry breaking via Yukawa interactions. So here is the Yukawa interaction, the Yukawa-Lagrangian that I wrote down before. There are three terms that are allowed, and here they are. I guess we should just return to that question I asked at the end of last class. Why did I write down these interactions and not other sorts of interactions? Let me just remind you what the bad interactions are. So I did not write down these, and I'm just going to omit the flavor indices for now. Epsilon H. I could have also have had H dagger, U bar right, U left, or E right bar LL transpose epsilon H. So I claimed that those were invalid somehow, and so I left it as an exercise to figure out why. Anyone have an idea?
Hypercharge,
right. So they're not allowed due to gauge invariance. They're fine with respect to SU3 color or SU2 left, but the hypercharges don't work out. And so each of these operators would carry net hypercharge, but we're only allowed to write down operators that are hypercharge neutral in the Lagrangian in order for it to be symmetric. So I don't want these. Here are the only ones that I'm allowed. The argument goes that the Higgs acquires a vacuum expectation value through spontaneous symmetry breaking. And so I should plug in in unitary gauge that the Higgs field takes a value of 1 over square root of 2, 0, v plus h. And then you just plug it in and expand. And we wrote down what that expression was on Friday. And so let me just write it in a slightly different way. So I have minus u bar right, and then times a matrix mu, u left, 1 plus h over v. I'm writing it in matrix notation, so I'll define everything in a second. Md, u left, 1 plus h over v, then minus e right, me, e left, 1 plus h over v. So in the second line here, I'm suppressing the flavor or generational indices, and I'm writing everything as vectors and matrices. So I'm defining a matrix M, U, D, E. And if you write its indices, it'd have indices ij, which is just the Yukawa matrix times the VEV divided by square root of 2. OK, so this is like the mass matrix for every type of fermion. And so these are just 3x3 matrices in generation space. And then I have, I'm lumping together all of the different generations of fermions as a column vector or a row vector, also in generation space. For example, if I write u left, this would be u left 1, u left 2, u left 3, or you could call it u left, c left, t left, for example. Okay? And so on. So you see how it works. All right, so now I have these matrices. And in general, they can be complex. They don't have to be diagonal. They don't have to be Hermitian. They can be anything. So we want to diagonalize that because we want masses that are diagonal. We want to find the mass eigenstates. So I argued at the end of last class that we can diagonalize an arbitrary matrix using a biunitary transformation. And so now we'll just do that. They are. Yeah, so it's not quite... No, so it's the eigen... The way to say it is that if you have your mass matrix M, the eigenvalues of M dagger M will be the masses squared. So it's not necessarily the eigenvalues of M itself. The eigenvalues of M dagger M. That will be the mass matrices. Well, we went through this argument at the end of the class on Friday. So... Let me just finish what I'm writing here. We can recap. So here's what we proved. Let's say you have an arbitrary square matrix M. So that's like one of our M's that's appearing in the Lagrangian on the left. Now if I write down M, M dagger, this is Hermitian with real positive eigenvalues. So we can diagonalize this using a unitary transformation. So I can write down U dagger, M, M dagger U is some diagonal matrix, which I'll call MD squared, which has its real positive eigenvalues along the diagonal. So then what I showed is that we can also diagonalize M itself, not through a unitary transformation, but a biunitary transformation. So I can write down U dagger, M V is just equal to some diagonal matrix MD, where now the diagonal entries are just the square roots, the positive square roots of what I had over here. And what is this matrix V? Well, you can write it as M dagger U MD inverse. So that's the argument that we went through. So the eigenvalues that you're finding when you diagonalize through a biunitary transformation are not the eigenvalues of M, they're the eigenvalues of M squared. Maybe I should mention there was a small caveat with this proof. I needed to be able to invert this matrix MD like this. That assumes that all of the eigenvalues here were non-zero. There is a way to generalize it to the case where you have zero eigenvalues, but for our purposes, it's not going to matter because for all of the mass matrices that we wrote down, they all have non-zero eigenvalues. All right. So here's the so we want to use this biunitary transformation to diagonalize what I wrote above. So we need to do a unitary transformation acting on the left and the right for each of these mass matrices. And let me just take one of them. We'll do the up type quark mass matrix. So I can diagonalize it in the following way. So I'll write U dagger. And I'll write this U with a subscript U right for reasons that will become apparent in a second. So that's one unitary matrix. And then I have the mass matrix MU. And then I act on the left with a different unitary matrix, which we'll call U with a subscript U left. So here's my biunitary transformation. I'm going to assume that this diagonalizes it to give you a diagonal matrix, which I'll call little m with a superscript U. And so this will just be the diagonal matrix with the eigenvalues MU1, MU2, MU3. Or I could write it in terms of, you know, of course, the masses, MU, MC, MT. So these are the the masses for the up quark, the charm quark, and the top quark. All right. So now that I have defined this transformation, I want to define or do a field redefinition to rotate my original basis of quark fields to the new basis in which the mass matrix is diagonal. So the new fields will be U left prime and U right prime. And they will be defined by the following. U left, U right, which is the original basis I started with, will be equal to U for U left, U right. And then U left, right prime. So the old basis is just the new basis acted on by the unitary transformation. Or you could have defined it the other way around with U dagger instead of U. You would have the new basis is equal to U dagger times the old basis. Either way is fine. OK, so now I can rewrite the mass terms. In diagonal form in terms of the new fields. So for example, I have U right bar M U left. This is equal to U right prime. And then U right dagger M U and then U left prime. And so now this whole thing is diagonalized. So this is just mu, and then u right prime, u left prime, like so. So now through the biunitary transformation, all of the mass terms are real and diagonal. And that was just for the up-type quarks, but you can do similar things for the other fields. So we have D left or right is equal to a different unitary matrix, D left or right, D left right prime. So again, this is the old basis and this is the new basis, which are the mass eigenstates. And then we have E left right is equal to U, E left or right, E left right prime. And then lastly, we have the neutrinos. Yeah?
Isn't there something that links UL1 to UR1? As in that makes that combination special?
No.
It's like you're taking a new basis
for
the L's and for the R's, but you're doing it in a different way.
Yeah, that'll end up being very important, as we'll see in a second. But there's no reason to say that they're linked together.
Makes you move between left-handed fermions and right-handed ones?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the confusion is exactly, so I don't know. But
I mean, those bases that we were working with don't seem like they were randomly picked. As in, it seemed like there was a connection between left and right, which you break if you use different bases.
As if there is no
able to like oscillate between different flavors.
Yeah, okay. So when I started out writing down the gauge interactions, I was working in a basis which you could call the gauge eigenstate basis. And in that basis, you would say that the gauge interactions are diagonal. Okay, so they don't mix different flavors together. Maybe I'm not answering questions, so I'll stop explaining it.
No, I think you are.
Okay, so if you start out in the gauge eigenstate basis in which the gauge interactions are diagonal, then what I'm doing is I'm just asking, okay, what happens when I now I'm trying to diagonalize the mass matrices? But working in the the gauge eigenstate basis, the gauge interactions only interact left-handed and left-handed, or right-handed and right-handed. And so among those two things, I'm free to do a rotation among the left-handed and right-handed fields separately, as long as that rotation still preserves the gauge symmetry. The only way it doesn't preserve the gauge symmetry, or the only way it the only way it preserves the gauge eigenstates is if you do a rotation in the left-handed fields in such a way that it preserves the SU2, which means that you can't rotate different components of an SU2 doublet differently. That's the only way it can be affected. But otherwise, you're free to rotate anything the way you like, which is what I'm doing. Yeah? Okay. Another comment is the unprime basis, in a sense, is a little bit arbitrary. So the original basis that we started out in is a little bit arbitrary. So you're free to do many different types of rotations, which would also preserve the interactions as we discussed. So, but I don't know if that addresses or just makes things more confusing. But let me continue on. Let's see, I forgot what I was going to say. Oh, yeah, neutrinos, right. So we can do exactly the same rotation for the down type fields and the charged lepton fields. We want to diagonalize each of their mass terms. But the neutrinos have no mass term, okay? So we're free to use any matrix we like to rotate them. We don't even have to if we don't want to. But it's very useful to take a particular choice, which is that you rotate the unprimed neutrino fields, the original fields, using exactly the same rotation matrix that you did for the charged leptons. So what I mean by this is that we have our new basis, nu left, which is equal to u e left nu left prime. So I'm defining some new basis, nu left prime, which is just the old basis rotated by exactly the same unitary transformation that I used for the left-handed charge fields. Okay, so I'm free to do that because there's no mass term for the neutrinos. I can rotate it by any unitary matrix. All right, so you'll see in a second why that is useful. All right, so having made this choice, we have now diagonalized all of the Fermion mass terms. So the Yukawa interaction takes the following form. I should just sum over all of the fermion species. And then I have the mass. And then psi bar psi 1 plus h over v. So that's what we have. So you can see, again, the implications of the Higgs mechanism. Because I'm generating the masses through spontaneous symmetry breaking, I automatically have to have the Higgs boson coupling to the same combination of psi bar psi. And the coupling is related to the mass divided by the VEV. Okay, so it's very determined, the structure of the theory. All right, so now we're going to consider what happens now to the gauge interactions. Having made these rotations among the different fields, we just need to check what happened to the gauge interactions that we wrote down earlier. So first, I'm going to consider what happens to the neutral current interactions. So let me write down what the neutral current is. This is just the electroweak neutral current, E q psi psi bar a slash psi. So this is a coupling for an arbitrary fermion psi, just couples proportional to electric charge. And then we have the photon field. Then g over cosine theta w, psi bar z slash. And then the coupling of the z goes like t3 left, p left, minus q, 9 squared theta w, and then psi. Okay, so here are the couplings of the photon and the z to our fermion psi. And let's take, for example, a particular case. So we're going to consider psi is equal to u I. So we'll just consider one of the up, or I should say the up-type quarks. Now, I just want to mention that the charge for all of the up-type quarks is the same, two-thirds. T3 left is always the same for all of the up-type quarks. It's just one-half. So now I just want to ask what happens when we transform to the mass eigenstate basis defined by these primed fields. So I just need to ask what happens to these bilinears when we do a rotation. So if I write down u bar left I, gamma mu, u bar left I, and I go to the primed basis, this is equal to u bar left j. And then I have u dagger u left, and then j I. And then I have gamma mu, and then I have u left I k. And then I have u prime left k. Like so. And then I should have a prime over here. All right. So now the gamma mu part only acts on the Dirac spinner space. Doesn't act on the generation space, of course. So the unitary matrix here will just go through. And I'll just have u dagger u will just give me Kronecker delta. So this whole thing is just u bar prime left I gamma mu u left prime I. So it's invariant because u is unitary. And it works the same way for all of the other fermion fields as well. Because I'm always, for the neutral current, I'm always going to have the same fermion appearing here as appears here. It's always going to be the same rotation. And I'm always going to have u dagger u. And it's always going to give me the identity. So the neutral current is unchanged. In the mass basis. And exactly the same argument also applies for the strong interaction as well. That also couples the same flavors together, and I'll always have u dagger u. So let's consider what happens to the charge current interaction. So I have minus g over the square root of 2, u bar left I, w slash plus d left I. Then I have nu left bar I, w plus slash e left I, plus summation conjugate. So now let's go through exactly the same argument. We're going to do the rotation. And the key thing to notice is that it's different fields appearing here and here. And so the rotations are not going to cancel, as we'll show. So I have minus g over the square root of 2. I have u bar L prime j. And then I have u left dagger jk, or ji. And then I have w plus slash. And then I have u e left ik, and then d prime left k. So that was the quark term. Now let's do the lepton term. I have nu bar prime j left u e left dagger j I w plus slash u e left I k, and then e left prime k. All right. So first, let's focus on the lepton part. And this is the reason why we wanted to choose the neutrino fields to be rotated by the same unitary matrix as the lepton fields, the charged lepton fields. Because now we have just u dagger u, the unitary matrices just cancel out. And this term here will just be nu left prime I w plus slash, and then e left prime I. So for the leptons, the charge current interaction is still diagonal. But for the quarks, it is not. So both up and down type quarks have non-zero mass matrices. And so I need to choose different unitary matrices here. And so they don't end up canceling out. I get this combination of u dagger for u left multiplied by u for d right. So let's define this as a matrix V. Is u left dagger, u e left. And this is known as the Kibibo-Maskawa-Kobayashi matrix, or the CKM matrix. And we can expand it out in terms of its various components, or I should just say its various entries. So it's written as VUD, VUS, VUB, VCD, VCS, VCB, VTD, VTS, VTB, like so. So okay, let me just finish and write out what this is. So I have u bar left I, vij, w plus slash, e prime, left j. Then I have plus u bar I prime left, w plus slash, e left I prime, like so. Plus Hermitian conjugate. Okay. So again, I have some leftover remnant of the fact that I had to diagonalize these matrices. And in general, the rotations don't cancel out. And so that is given by this extra matrix V, the CKM matrix. And you can see the elements, V, I, J, they have the following meaning, of course, that those are the couplings that connect flavor J and flavor I through the charge-current interaction. So charge current interaction connects quarks of different flavor. So the Feynman rule for the W would look like this, ui dj, this would be minus ij over square root of 2, bij gamma mu d left. I should write primes here, right? Because of the mass eigenstate fields. From now on, I'm just going to drop the primes. We're always going to be working in the mass eigenstate basis. Similarly, for the neutrinos and charged leptons, I'll have a W plus, and they will connect a neutrino, flavor I, with the same flavor of charged lepton. So if I write it as I and J here, it has to be proportional to Kronecker delta, minus G over square root of 2, delta ij, and then gamma mu, p left. Mu. All right, so here are the Feynman rules. So this is the prediction of the standard model, and the fact that we have one Higgs, which is giving masses to all of the fermions modulo the neutrinos, the prediction is that only the charge current interactions change quark flavor, right? The neutral current interactions, the interactions of the Higgs, the interactions of gluons, interactions of the photon, they all preserve quark flavor. It's only charge current interactions that change quark flavor. I just want to make one last comment on this before we move on. When people talk about flavor of different quarks, they just mean the mass eigenstates. When people talk about flavor of charged leptons, they also mean the mass eigenstates. For the neutrinos, when people say flavor, they mean something a little bit different. Flavor means, for neutrinos, the same basis as the charged leptons. Or in other words, when the W decays to a given charged lepton, the neutrino that it decays to is the flavor of that neutrino. It's the flavor eigenstate of that neutrino corresponding to a given charged lepton. Okay? It's different than the mass eigenstates of the neutrinos. When we put in neutrino masses, as we'll do at the end of the course, those will be a different basis. So I just want to mention that. All right.
So yeah. In the theory of massive neutrinos, does the last term still remain the same?
No. So when we put in massive neutrinos, we'll have to give neutrinos their own matrix to diagonalize them. And so now the interaction, the charge current interaction for leptons will also involve a matrix, which is called the PMNS matrix. So it'll be another unitary matrix that we can put in. All right. So we're going to talk very briefly about effective field theory for the weak interaction. So what we've written down before is the whole standard model Lagrangian. So we're fine to compute anything we like, in principle. But when you're working at energies much, much lighter than the masses of the W and Z bosons, you don't need to use the full standard model Lagrangian to compute everything. You can use what's called an effective Lagrangian, where you have integrated out some of the degrees of freedom, namely the W and the Z, or other heavier states as well. So we can write down an effective interaction for the weak interaction in this way, using an effective Lagrangian. So I'm just going to consider the example of muon decay. Muon decay is one of the most basic types of weak decays you can have. And it was one of the early manifestations of the weak interaction. But the mass of the muon is much, much lighter than the mass of the W. All right, so we don't need to put in the W as a dynamical degree of freedom. We can write down an effective interaction. But let's first just compute the matrix element in the full standard model. So we have the matrix element for mu goes to nu mu, electron, antineutrino. So I have the Feynman rules up there. I'm going to use the Feynman rule that appears on the right. So I have U bar E, and then I have I G over square root of 2 with a minus sign. So I'm going to leave off the momenta for the external states. The only one I need to worry about is, I should put them in. Hold on. Let me just write the Feynman diagram. Get a muon, and I want to call this momentum P. Nu mu is momentum P prime. Here's the W of momentum K. The electron of momentum Q. And the electron antineutrino of momentum Q prime. OK, so here's the Feynman diagram. I'm going to leave off the momenta in the spinners. All right, just for brevity. Gamma mu, P left, V nu E. And I have the W propagator. And then I have U bar mu mu minus IG over square root of 2 gamma nu, E left, and then U for the muon. So the first thing I want to argue is that this term will be very, very small. So I'm going to use the Dirac equation. So the k mu here will just get contracted with the gamma mu here. K nu would get contracted with the gamma nu here. And so I need to consider bilinears where I have a k slash between the spinners. So I'll have, for example, u bar e, k slash, p left, v nu e. And so I have nu e, q slash plus q prime slash p left, and then v for nu e. All right, so when the q prime goes over here, it'll change it to a p left, but then when the q prime acts on the v, it'll just give you 0, because I'm assuming the neutrino is massless. And when the q acts on the left with the ue, it'll just give us the electron mass. So it'll just give us me times u bar e, p left, v nu e. And same things for the muon bilinear. This will give us m mu times u bar nu mu. Oops, put this wrong. Be nu mu, this one is mu. And then he writes u mu. OK, so those two terms will be suppressed by their masses. So this term here will be suppressed by m e m mu over mw squared, which is of order 10 to the minus 8. Okay, so we don't need that term. Another thing we can throw away is k squared. Right, because all the energies and momenta involved are going to be of order the mass of the muon, 100 MeV, that would be much, much smaller compared to mw squared. Mw is around 80 GeV. So we can get rid of that one too. So here's what we have left over. Ig squared over 8 mw squared ue bar gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5 nu e, oops, b nu e u bar nu mu gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5 u mu. Okay, so I've just converted the p less to 1 minus gamma 5 over 2 and pulled out the factors of a half and then combined them all up to make a factor of 1 eighth. All right, there we go. So this is what the matrix element looks like at leading order in terms that are not suppressed by the mass of the w. This matrix element we can represent by an operator, a four fermion operator, which is our effective operator. Here's the effective operator. Constant g fermi over square root of 2, e bar gamma mu, 1 minus gamma 5, nu e, and then nu bar mu, gamma mu, 1 minus gamma 5, mu plus Hermitian conjugate. Okay, so if you take the matrix element of what's on the bottom, you'll get the same matrix element as what you get on the top. So historically, people worked out the form of this interaction long before they knew about what exactly were the degrees of freedom that were generating it. All right. But now we have a deeper understanding. We can start with the full fundamental theory and then derive what the effective interaction is. All right. The virtue of that is then now, instead of having this arbitrary constant, we can predict that constant in terms of the degrees of freedom which are generating that interaction just by matching the two things together. So Fermi's constant divided by square root of 2 is just d squared over 8 mw squared. So this is not the only type of interaction, effective interaction, that will arise through the W. The W can connect any fermions, right? And so we could write down a whole host of effective interactions. So we can write down interactions similar to what I just wrote before, but now coupling any two species of lepton flavor. And then I have nu bar j gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5 ej plus permission conjugate. So this is analogous to what I wrote down before. These are leptonic interactions, leptonic four fermion interactions. But the W can also connect quarks and leptons as well. So I can write down the following. I should have a Vij here. Then I have Ui gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5 dj. Then I have E bar k gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5 nu k. So these are connecting the lepton charge currents to the quark charge currents. These are known as semi-leptonic interactions. And then I can also connect hadronic currents together. Just need to sum over more indices. So we'll have Vij BKL star U bar I gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5 EJ and E bar L gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5 UK and then everything is plus Hermitian conjugate. These last class of interactions are known as hadronic interactions. They're only involving quarks. All right. So if you just started out with an effective theory, let's say you measure a variety of different decays, which are changing flavors of different types of fermions. And if you parameterize it as an arbitrary four fermion interaction, or I should say as an arbitrary set of four fermion interactions, there's no reason that you should have the same coefficient governing all of them. But when you start out from the gauge theory and work your way down, what you find is that you have exactly the same coupling, which enters into all of the different interactions. All right? Modulo the CKM matrix. So except for that one matrix, the weak interaction is universal. That is the same G Fermi for every type of four fermion interaction you can write down. It also explains why the Dirac structure is the same for all of them. All of them have this characteristic Dirac structure, which takes the following form. So I should write down that the gauge theory of the standard model explains the universality of the weak interaction. Strength G Fermi over the square root of 2. And it also explains, I guess, the same universality for the Dirac structure, which is known as V minus A cross V minus A. V just means vector current. A means axial current. And it always has the structure of the vector current, gamma mu, minus the axial current, gamma mu, gamma 5. That's what it means, v minus a. So that's the motivation for wanting to embed the weak interaction in a gauge theory. Phenomenologically, or I should say experimentally, we observe that these are true, at least with an experimental precision. We've observed that they seem to have this universal Dirac structure and a universal gauge strength, modulo the CKM matrix. So that's the motivation for embedding the weak interaction in a gauge theory. So now, what is this constant G Fermi? Well, okay, we computed it over here, but we can expand it a little bit. So we can use the fact that MW is equal to G times the VeV over 2. And so that tells us that G Fermi divided by square root of 2 is just 1 over 2 times the VeV squared. So the factors of G will end up canceling out, and we'll just be left with the VeV. So it tells us that the Higgs VeV is equal to the square root of 2 G Fermi, and then you just take the minus 1 half power of that. So it's kind of cool that once you measure G Fermi in, let's say, muon decay at energy scales of 100 MeV, you've determined what the Higgs VeV has to be at much higher energies. So what is it? You can plug in the value for G Fermi, and it's around 246 GeV. So there we are. I just want to mention very briefly that there is an alternate convention for VeVs. So instead of writing the Higgs field as 0 V plus H over square root of 2, sometimes people write it as H 0 V plus H over square root of 2. So it's just a difference by a factor of square root of 2. Just mention that so you don't get confused. So instead of having 246 GeV, the value is 174 GeV. All right, so it's just a different convention. But it's the same. It's the same. All right. Okay. So lastly, let me just finish up with our discussion of the standard model. So we've written down the standard model Lagrangian. So in principle, you can compute everything as a function of the parameters of the standard model. So let's just go over what the parameters are for the standard model. So there are three gauge couplings. G prime, which are the electroweak gauge couplings, and then the strong coupling, GS. There's two Higgs parameters. Which are the two parameters that enter into the Higgs potential, lambda and mu squared. We can swap mu squared for the Higgs mass, so I can write that as mh squared, which is 2 times mu squared. And then lambda. So in terms of these parameters, other things that you would want to measure are fixed, such as the mass of the W, the mass of the Z, and the VeV are all fixed in terms of those parameters. Then there's 9 fermion masses. So we have, ME, MU, M tau, MU, MC, MT, MD, MS, and MB. Not including neutrino masses. And then lastly, we have parameters of the CKM matrix element. Parameters of the CKM matrix. And it's a 3x3 unitary matrix. But it actually only has four independent parameters. I guess you guys will go through in tutorial or on a homework. Yeah, tutorial, you'll see why it has four. Why are there not more? So it's a 3x3 matrix. All right. So that parameterizes the whole matrix Vij. There's actually one more parameter in the standard model, which I haven't written down and I haven't discussed. It's known as theta QCD. It effectively parameterizes a CP-violating interaction of gluon fields. But as far as we can tell, theta QCD is zero or very, very close to zero for reasons that are still mysterious. So that's a puzzle. But OK. So here are the parameters we have. We have 3, 5, 9, 18 parameters in the standard model. So that's it. Those are the parameters. Everything can be computed in principle in terms of those parameters. There are a couple caveats to that. If you want to calculate anything in low energy QCD, anything related to the strong interactions at low energies, very, very difficult, even though we know the parameters. There are also, if you want to include neutrino masses, there will be new parameters which encode neutrino masses and neutrino mixings. Okay, so those would be additional parameters on top of what we had there. And also, I should say, it doesn't include any unsolved problems at the moment, like dark matter or dark energy. Or things like that. So those are also not parameters of the standard model. But there we go. So there are some features of the standard model which are very economical, like having one Higgs, giving mass to everything, having gauge symmetries. But the caveat is that the standard model has many, many different parameters. We don't know where they all come from. OK, so that concludes the standard model. And then tomorrow, we're going to change topics and discuss something else related to the standard model. Beyond the Lagrangian. Okay.